the faces of my least favorite professors, my harshest and most cynical colleagues, and my most unforgiving online critics. I would think to myself, if I can keep them happy, or at the very least quiet, I'll be good to go. The outcome was the worst case scenario for a researcher or a social scientist. Findings that were gently folded into pre-existing ways of seeing the world. Findings that carefully nudged existing ideas, but did so without upsetting anyone. Findings that were safe, filtered, and comfortable. But none of that was authentic. It was a tribute. So I decided that I had to fire those naysayers and fearmongers. In their places, I began to summon up men and women who have shaped the world with their courage and creativity, and who have, at least on occasion, pissed off some people. They are a varied bunch. J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter books I love so much, is my go-to person when I'm struggling with how to introduce a new and strange world of ideas that has only just emerged from my research. I imagine her telling me, "New worlds are important, Brené, but you can't just describe them. Give us the stories that make up that universe. No matter how wild and weird the new world might be, we'll see ourselves in the stories." The author and activist Bell Hooks comes to the fore when there's a painful conversation happening around race, gender, or class. She's taught me about teaching as a sacred act and the importance of discomfort in learning. Ed Catmull, Shonda Rhimes, Ken Burns, they stand behind me whispering in my ear while I'm telling a story. They nudge me when I become impatient and start skipping the details and dialogue that really bring meaning to storytelling. "Take us with you into that story," they insist. Countless musicians and artists also show up, as does Oprah. Her advice is actually tacked to the wall in my study. "Do not think you can be brave with your life and your work and never disappoint anyone. It doesn't work that way." But my oldest and most steadfast counselor is Maya Angelou. I was introduced to her work 32 years ago when I was studying poetry in college. I read her poem, "Still I Rise," and everything shifted for me. It contained such power and beauty. I collected every Angelou book, poem, and interview I could find. And her words taught me. They pushed me and they healed me. She managed to be both full of joy and unsparing. But there was one quote from Maya Angelou that I deeply disagreed with. It was a quote on belonging, which I came across when I was teaching a course on race and class at the University of Houston. In an interview with Bill Moyers that aired on public TV in 1973, Dr. Angelou said, "You are only free when you realize you belong no place. You belong every place, no place at all. The price is high, the reward is great." You know, I can remember exactly what I thought when I read that quote. That's just wrong. What kind of world would it be if we belonged nowhere? Just a bunch of lonely people coexisting. I don't think she actually understands the power of belonging. For over 20 years, whenever that quote popped up in my life, I felt a rush of anger. Why would she say that? It's just not true. Belonging is essential. We must belong to something, to someone, to somewhere. I soon realized that the anger came from two places. First, Dr. Angelou had come to mean so much to me that I just couldn't stand the thought that we disagreed on something so fundamental. Second, the need to fit in and the ache of not belonging was one of the most painful threads in my own life. I could not accept the idea of belonging nowhere as freedom. Feeling like I never truly belonged anywhere was my greatest pain, a personal suffering that threaded through most of my pre-adult life. It was in no way my liberation. Experiences of not belonging are the time markers of my life, and they started early. I attended pre-K and kindergarten at Paul Habens Elementary on the West Bank of New Orleans. It was 1969, and as wonderful as the city was and still is, it was a place suffocated by racism. Schools had only become officially desegregated the year I started. I didn't know or understand much about what was happening. I was too young. But I knew that my mom was outspoken and tenacious. She spoke up a lot and even wrote a letter to the Times-Picayune challenging the legality of what today we'd call racial profiling. I could sense that energy around her, but to me, she was just a volunteer in my homeroom and the person who made me, herself, and